Welcome back to the Roundtable. I'm Ian Pickus. It seems clear at this point that immigration will be a key issue in the 2020 elections, both for president and in the all-important campaigns for U.S. Senate. My guest, Jeff Merkley, is taking that fight on full bore. The second-term U.S. Senator from Oregon, a Democrat, is out with a new book called America is Better Than This: Trump's War Against Migrant Families. In it, he covers his own experiences visiting Central America, what he saw at migrant detention centers on the U.S.-Mexico border, and his conversations with Trump administration officials about their policies. Merkley previously served as Speaker of the Oregon House of Representatives. Senator, welcome to the Roundtable.
Thank you so much. Good to be with you.
Why do you call it a war in the title of your book?
Well, the president has developed this philosophy of deliberately hurting migrants as a strategy to deter immigration. And so it is a battlefield in which they're finding every possible way to inflict harm, and that's why I call it a war.
Okay, so for people who've maybe heard the headlines but haven't paid very close attention, what is the state of play as you see it in terms of America's policy for migrants?
Well, the courts closed the door on the most egregious form of child separation. The administration opened a back door to that strategy, however, continuing to separate children from their parents, and in addition said that they want to lock up children in prison indefinitely who are refugees coming to this country. And so just this week, they issued a regulation that would take effect in 60 days that says that that is the U.S. government under President Trump, can imprison children who come to the border. This whole idea is, in plan A was traumatize children through child separation. If not that, then plan B, traumatize children through imprisonment. And this is a dark and evil strategy, and I can't believe, none of us really should be able to believe, that it's our government, our tax funds, our land being used in this egregious act against children.
How did a senator from a non-border state get so wrapped up in this issue?
Well, it was the early days of June last year, 2018, when I was reading Jeff Sessions, who was then the Attorney General, his speech called Zero Tolerance. And I thought, well, zero tolerance, that sounds like a Republican talking point 6 months out from an election. And I read the details. And I said, you know, it sounds like zero humanity. It sounds like they're planning to deliberately hurt children. I can't believe that any American administration, Democrat or Republican, left or right, would ever do such a thing. And so it must be mostly rhetoric, not reality. And a member of my team said, well, there's one way to find out, and that's to visit the border. And so I flew down and became the first member of Congress to get through the door of the Ursula Border Processing Facility and see the children who had been torn out of their parents' arms being locked into these chain-link cages in a warehouse. And it was a stunning thing to experience. And I went outside, the press asked about it, I explained to them what I'd seen. The Washington Post gave me Pinocchios because they said, surely there aren't such cages. And it turned out, of course, there were, and now the whole world calls them that. I went up the road to a former Walmart, what I had been told was housing hundreds of these children. And I thought, well, I'll go up there and knock on their door and see how these children are being treated. And the administration did not give me permission to get in. Even when I knocked on the door and said, well, come out and at least talk to me, they called the police, and it ended up creating a viral video because it conveyed the secrecy of what the administration was doing. They did not want people to truly understand that they were deeply traumatizing children as a deliberate act under their theory of deterring immigration.
When you raised the issue with Sessions and others, what did they say?
Well, Sessions stuck to talking points that consisted of, well, if we discourage immigration in this fashion, in the end, it'll end up helping children because their parents will not go embark on a difficult journey as refugees. That was his defense. And so in the name of some future theoretical protect children from a difficult journey, they had justified their infliction of direct trauma on children, direct and lasting trauma.
Let's stop on that point for a second. What is the lasting effect on a child separation for a young child?
So envision this. You are a child growing up in a village somewhere in the world. Your family is threatened with death. You flee. Everything is different from that point forward. But the one thing you have is you go through thousands of miles and border checkpoints and different forms of transportation and camping out along the road. The one thing you have is your parent next to you, your parent's hand. And then people are speaking different languages, and you're crossing big, formidable-looking facilities at a border, and suddenly someone comes, puts your parent into shackles, marches them away, and you have nothing. And it's a huge impact. We had lots of testimony from child experts who have studied this around the world, and they lay out how, in some cases, the child thinks the parents abandoned them. In other cases, they develop a lifelong fear of institutions. They become angry. They regress. And for example, as one woman talked about, her son, who was 4 or 5 years old, went back to wanting to be breastfed when she finally was reunified with him later. Other parents talking to their parents, their children cowering behind couches. It's just a whole fiercely traumatizing experience. And as experts also weighed in and said, the chemicals in the brain change under the stress, and it changes the wiring of your brain, and that's where the lasting impact comes from.
Now, President Trump and his administration have argued that they've been very open about what their policies are, and the country is full, in their words, and the migrants who are coming from Central America are effectively breaking the law by crossing the border, and that the U.S. does not have an obligation to house them or resettle them in any way. Why are they wrong?
Well, the president says come to ports of entry because we don't want you to cross between ports of entry. And so people have come to the ports of entry, and they've been met with a border blockade by the administration. I witnessed this on my second trip to the border, which was on Father's Day in June of last year. I took a congressional delegation. We saw the CBP guards lined up at the border line on the bridge, the pedestrian bridge between Reynosa and Hidalgo, and they would stop anyone who was a refugee seeking asylum and send them back into Mexico. That then became more sophisticated in a system called metering, where people are rejected at the port of entry. And if you think about this picture that gained some notoriety a few weeks ago, in which a father and a little girl named Valeria died, Oscar and Valeria died in each other's arms, drowning in the Rio Grande. They came to the port of entry. They asked for asylum as validated under U.S. law and under international law that we are part of through a treaty. And they were rejected. They were sent back into a very hostile setting where they didn't have friends or family or funds. And so they did the next safest thing, which was try to cross outside of the port of entry and ask a border guard for asylum. And they died crossing the border. So when the administration says it's a criminal act to cross between ports of entry, but they are forcing people to do that, they are conducting a big lie with the American people.
Okay, how now that you've laid out what you see as this issue, this problem, how would you like to go about fixing it? Because clearly the migrants are going to keep coming from Central America, where things are very unsafe.
Well, one thing we should do is invest in Central America. The drug gangs took over there, and they get their money from selling their drugs in the United States. They get their guns from the United States. So we are tied into what the forces that have overwhelmed the traditional institutions of justice and welfare. And so we would be well placed to spend money helping the traditional institutions regain the upper hand. And we spend virtually nothing there at this point. And so we should do that. We should then invest in case management. So when somebody asks for refugee status, you don't automatically get asylum. You have to go and prove your case in court. Most people cannot do that. They cannot get the documentation to do it. The burden of proof is significant. So they are deported back home. But the reason they show up at their hearings is because they have a case manager who lets them know exactly where they need to show up, what paperwork they need to bring, how to prepare for it, how to get the legal assistance to prepare. Then they show up, and if they don't make their case. They're deported, but they've been treated with decency and respect. And that's the point here. Treat people with decency and respect. The president has dehumanized immigrants. He has called them rapists and murderers, which is just, he's reused the word animals and infestations. This is just a terrible racist strategy by the president of dehumanizing people so that they can be abused by the administration and have the administration feel it's okay. It is not okay. We are a nation that says in our Pledge of Allegiance, one nation under God, indivisible, meaning we're not going to let people divide us into different ethnic groups or races or colors. We're going to work together to make this a more successful nation, and we need to return to that vision of a nation united, building a more successful and prosperous United States of America.
We're speaking with U.S. Senator Jeff Merkley, a Democrat from Oregon. I want to get you on some other issues here while we have you. Why aren't you running for president like so many of your Democratic Senate colleagues?
Oh, my goodness. I was interested in doing so because I wanted to put this nation back on track on so many issues. The fundamentals for families, health care, housing, education, living wage jobs, taking on the corruption in our constitutional system that has turned it from government by and for the people to by and for the powerful, the gerrymandering, the voter suppression, the dark money, taking on ending discrimination for LGBT community with the Equality Act, which I wrote in 2015, taking on carbon pollution and the huge climate chaos impacts it has. None of that is happening because our nation is fundamentally corrupted. But in the end, I looked at it and said, there are only a few people with the money in the organization to be serious contenders. I do not have the money. I do not have the organization. And you know what? Whoever's in the Oval Office has to have a Senate that works in order to put America back on track. I saw the Senate when it worked. I was in an intern for Senator Hatfield back in 1976. I worked for the House and Senate in the 1980s on strategic nuclear policy. There were no supermajorities. The place functioned as a legislative body. It is now profoundly broken. Mitch McConnell is destroying the U.S. Senate, and so my assignment to myself is to do everything I can to change that.
Do you agree with former leader Harry Reid that the filibuster should be a thing of the past?
Absolutely. And here's why. People have this false notion that a supermajority, which is what the filibuster is, you have to have a supermajority to close debate, that somehow that will cause people to work together. That only works if people want to work together. And when the Republicans are in the minority, they don't want to work together because Mitch McConnell tested the theory of 100% paralysis using the filibuster as his weapon of legislative destruction, which meant that Democrats, when in charge, they weren't able to deliver on the priorities for working America, and that resulted in a lot of cynicism and discouragement. The Republicans changed their priorities, which were the Supreme Court and tax breaks for the rich, to a simple majority. They changed the rules in both cases to simple majority for their priorities while we still face a supermajority for things for working America. So that is way out of whack. It should be a simple majority for working Americans and a supermajority of things that help the powerful. After all, they don't need help. So the Senate's completely stood on its head by the abuse of the supermajority, and thus we really have no choice now but to end it.
Last presidential election cycle, you backed a senator from our neck of the woods, Bernie Sanders. Who do you like this time?
Well, I love so many of our candidates, and they're bringing valuable elements to the conversation. It's going to be a very long time before I endorse, but I so much respect and appreciate folks who are setting other things aside in life to lay out their vision for America.
Well, do you think we should read anything into the fact that you haven't endorsed Sanders this time? I'll ask it that way.
No, you shouldn't read anything into that. I endorsed at a time there were only two candidates in the race 4 years ago. And when there are a small number of candidates, there's a good chance I'll endorse again. I felt strongly that one vision was stronger than the other 4 years ago. And if I feel that again, I'll make another endorsement.
Okay, let's quickly talk about impeachment. You're supportive of those efforts, right?
I am indeed.
What do you say to the argument that, hey, the election season's already started, let the American people decide for themselves?
What I would say is that my first political act in life was when I was a junior in high school, and the vice president, Spiro Agnew, was convicted of bribery, of taking $100,000 in bribes, and his penalty in the court was $10,000. And I'm like, what? Is this the way equal justice under law works? An ordinary person who steals a loaf of bread goes to prison for 5 years, and if you're rich, you get to keep 90% of the proceeds of your crime? And so I fired off a letter to the newspaper saying this was just egregious and wrong, and they printed it. And I feel like we have institutions like the Senate and the court and the executive branch that are in deep trouble, but we also have principles that are in deep trouble. And engraved above the doors of the Supreme Court are four words: equal justice under law. And if you'd asked me 5 months ago, I would have said, I'm waiting to see what the Mueller report says. Well, here's what it says. It says in four cases, there is extensive evidence that the president obstructed justice. There are three things that must be met: an obstructive act, a connection to a criminal proceeding, and an intent for that connection to be there. It's not an accidental connection. And Mueller laid out the evidence on all three points for four egregious cases of obstruction. So if the House does not act, they are complicit in destroying the principle of equal justice under law. They are the only group that can act. There's no way the Department of Justice will act. And so it is important to move. I think they should move quickly. I think they should, by the end of September, they should be done. Don't explore every possible wrong thing this president has done. But at a minimum, look at those four cases the Mueller report lays out. Lay it out very clearly. Hold the hearings. Hold a vote. Get it done by the end of September. And then it's up to the Senate as to what happens next.
And clearly, Mitch McConnell is not going to move forward with that effort. So what happens then?
It is not as clear as you might think, because there is an obligation under the law to hold a trial. And just as he stole a Supreme Court seat, he might be the first one in history not to convene a trial, but it's not clear it would unfold in that fashion. And that would be the responsibility of the Senate and all of us in the Senate to make sure that when we took our oath of office and said we would follow the Constitution, that we do so, the vision in the Constitution for the responsibility of the Senate to hold a trial.
That's U.S. Senator Jeff Merkley. He's a Democrat from Oregon, and the name of his new book is America is Better Than This, Trump's War Against Migrant Families. Senator, thank you so much for spending all this time with us.
Thank you. It's been great to be with you. I so much appreciate that you're covering this issue.
And you're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.